Welcome to On Demand. This is our AFR exclusive podcast. I'm your host, Jenna Ellis, where we do a deep dive into the issues that you care about, need to know about, with guests that you want to hear from. And so today we are doing a deep dive into an issue that should concern all of us and does concern all of us, which is the nature of reality, right? So, and you're thinking probably like, wow, this is a podcast that's going to be at least 5 hours long. It could be even longer than that, but we're going to go relatively quickly through all of this. But we need to talk about the state of reality as it relates to the LGBTQ mafia nonsense. And this appeared this week in the Supreme Court arguments. I mean, yes, actually arguing non-reality in front of the highest court in the nation. This is where we're at in today's society. And the case is Childs v. Salazar. And this was and is an attempt to overturn a Colorado law that prevents doctors or other healthcare professionals from practicing quote unquote conversion therapy, which again is, you know, the left likes to label all of these things that either make them sound, you know, better or worse depending on their preferred outcome. Basically, all that is at stake here is a therapist, their right to counsel minors according to reality, to say that men are men and women are women, you can't change your gender, and if you have gender dysphoria, or basically you are confused by this culture that is telling you that you can change your gender, here is the truth of reality. Well, that is against the law in Colorado and over 20 other states. This is how insane America has become. And so the Supreme Court has heard arguments on whether or not licensed therapists and these professionals can actually tell kids the truth. That's really all that it's come down to. And so we want to talk about, you know, all of this, what's really going on and kind of the big picture, and then we'll get into this case a little more. But I want to welcome in my guest, Mike Donnelly, for regular listeners of the morning show, Jenna Ellis in the Morning. He's a fan favorite. A lot of you always tell me that. And he's been a fan favorite of mine personally for, you know, going on over a decade. Has so much wisdom, has taught me so much about the Constitution, international law. So he is a constitutional law attorney. He's opinionated, as he says, on his X account at Donnelly Speaks, which you should absolutely follow. So, Mike, welcome to On Demand. And, you know, kind of the big picture here, you know, what is going on with how insane it is that the Colorado Solicitor General could actually get up in the midst of an argument at the U.S. Supreme Court and argue that gender itself, sex, biological sex, is not immutable. I mean, that would be literally the same thing as arguing that grass isn't green or that we can legislate ourselves out of the Earth's orbit or some other kind of nonsense.
Well, you're absolutely right, Jenna. And I can tell you, since you invited me to participate in this podcast this morning and or whatever people are listening to, it's morning for me. And good morning, good day to you who's listening, wherever you happen to be. I've really been praying about this because this is a very weighty matter. This is a weighty topic. It has become reflective of the battle of good versus evil in our country, in a way that makes it so clear, yet there are so many people who are confused, which is in itself confusing in some respects. But when the Bible talks about, you know, the gospel being foolishness to those who are blind, we can see that people can be blinded by the lies of the enemy, even though those of us who, you know God and have a relationship with him and know scripture can say it's as plain as day. It's like, you know, the grass is green, right? You know, words matter. And so I've been really praying about this because this is a weighty matter, because there are so many people, young people, children, because they're going after children. And the reality is these children, these people are confused. What has confused them? Well, this is, it's simple as it is complex. It goes back to the very beginning, because what was it that Satan did in the garden? He said to Eve, he said what? He said, you can be like God, knowing good from evil. And ultimately, that's what really is at the heart of sin. And what separates us from God is that we choose to reject him and to reject the truth that is plain as day right in front of us. And it is a choice. It's not immutable, right? God gives us a choice to follow him, to submit to him. But, you know, he told us who we are at the very beginning, and he recorded it for us in Scripture. He says, I am creating you in the image of myself. Male and female, I am creating you, to personalize it. But what's the problem? How is it that people become confused? Well, Satan, the enemy, is the father of lies, right? Jesus talked about this in his ministry. He said to those Pharisees, you are like your father, the devil. He was a liar from the beginning, a murderer, denying the truth. That is what he always does, Satan. He denies the truth, and he gets other people to deny the truth with him to deflect them from God. Because what's God's purpose for us anyway? God's purpose for us. Like, people may ask, you may be listening right now, you may be wondering, what's God's purpose in my life? God has a purpose for you, and he reveals that very clearly. His purpose for you is to be reconciled to him so that you can bring him glory. That's why he sent Jesus. Because we sinned, all sinned in Adam, everyone. When Adam sinned by disobeying God's instructions, he passed that sin on to everyone else in the human race all the way down. And so we inherited that sin. Now, we can make a choice to be reconciled to God, but that sin has corrupted all of creation. And we see that all around us. But he said he told us who we were, and he provided a way for us to be reconciled to him through Christ. And that's the battle that's going on. And so there may be people listening right now who are struggling, who are confused, who are struggling with sin. It may be this sin of gender, so-called gender identity, gender dysphoria, not being, you know, confident that you were born the right way. I can tell you right now, you were born the right way. You were born who you are for a reason. Look, your identity does not come from inside you. It is not constructed by you. It is received by you from the one who made you. God created you the way you are for a purpose, and he wants you to understand that. And how can you understand that? It's very simple. Recognize who you are in Adam, a sinner, and then recognize who you can be through Christ, our Savior. Jesus came. He was a real person. He lived a real life. He died a real death on the cross and was resurrected. This is a historical fact. You can check the evidence. It's true. And he did that so that you, by faith in him, by trusting in that penalty, that atonement, that payment that he made for all sin, for our sin, for the sin of everyone who puts their faith in him, you can be reconciled to God, and you can receive an identity in Christ, and then you can live a life that is glorifying to God and acknowledge that you were created by him the way you are. So, Jenna, when we talk about what's really going on, that's what's really going on. And all this other stuff, court cases and legislation and, you know, people arguing, you know, oh, boys can play sports and girls. Let's cut to the chase. This is an attack on God's word by Satan, and this is just one of the ways he does it.
Mm. Preach. And I was just thinking, as you were explaining so clearly the truth and how we as human beings are made in the image of God, and it is through his image in us that human beings have inherent dignity and value over and above anything else in all of creation. The Bible tells us that. It's a good thing, Mike, that you're not a licensed therapist in Colorado, right? Because you wouldn't be able...
If I said that, I would be violating the law, right?
Right? And isn't that insane that a licensed therapist in Colorado and 20 other states can't speak that truth when especially a minor who is listening, you know, to and is confronted with all of the lies in our society. And, you know, whether it's at school, it's just through their friends, it's through all of the ways that social media and the entertainment media, you know, attack reality in our worldview, they have questions. And that when parents decide to bring them to counselors, Christian counselors, that Christian counselors in these states are prohibited from simply speaking the truth that you did just now. I mean, this is what's at stake. And you're absolutely right that the big picture of this is as old of a lie as in the Garden of Eden, when the lie said, but did God really say, and that you can be like God, you can make reality into whatever you prefer and make yourself a human being into your own image of what you think God should be instead of looking at reality as it is. And there are a lot of different ways that Satan has tried to lie and has done so very effectively to humans throughout world history, throughout biblical history. And this matters because who we are and how we understand our relationship with God and who we are as being made in God's image. This directly relates to who we are as physical human beings. And Nancy Piercy, who for those who she was formerly an atheist, and then through a survey of world religions, as she was actually looking to discredit Christianity, she ended up becoming a Christian herself and is now one of the finest apologists for the Christian worldview. And she's written a number of books, Total Truth, Finding Truth. These are all great books. But a few years ago, and this is probably about 10 years ago now, with the rise of the LGBTQ movement, she wrote a book called Love Thy Body. And I highly recommend it because her explanation throughout this book about why this matters, because our bodies are not just a vessel for our soul. We're not to only look at spiritual matters and deny the physical. This all correlates to how God made us as human beings and how we understand our physical bodies and how God made us in his image directly relates to how we understand our relationship with him. We understand our need for him as a savior. We understand who we are as made in his image. All of these things, it is no wonder that the devil is attacking gender, sex, sexuality, and confusing the culture with all these lies. And Mike, I was also looking at a post on social media where you know, a friend of mine posted an article from the New York Times of, you know, of all places, that's supposed to be like all the news that's fit to print and all that. Or maybe that's the Wall Street Journal, whatever. But, you know, they pretend they're this high and lofty outlet. And this portion of this piece was talking about a person who now identifies as, you know, they, them, and, you know, gender dysphoria, talking about how so confused sexually they were because but saying this as if this is totally normal, that this person is now in a polyamorous relationship while being married to somebody of the same sex and, you know, all this stuff. And it's like going on and describing this just, you know, incredibly confused relationship with multiple other people that obviously has a sexual component. And I just thought, how does this person get anything else done in life, right? Because it's like they're so focused on their identity sexually that nothing else matters. And I thought, how often is it in today's society that everybody identifies with just who they are in their sexual orientation, their sex in terms of their biological sex or not, or, you know, their relationships, and all of that is the focus to distract us from the only relationship that ultimately really matters, which is with our Lord and Savior, that should then dictate how our relationships are to other people, our families, our spouses, our church relationships, our civil government. I mean, all of these things, it has to start with the primary. But I mean, do you see that as well? That it's like people are so obsessed with just their sexual relationships. It's like, we don't talk about any other kinds of relationships, even in the New York Times.
Yeah, no, I do. And you know, Jenna, this has been a movement decades in the making, literally. I mean, well, from the very beginning, Satan has used all kinds of things. But this one, he's been planting the seeds for a very long time, since the 30s, 40s, even going back to Margaret Sanger in the early 1900s. And then it started to bear fruit in the 60s with the so-called sexual revolution. But this isn't anything new. This is what the Gnostics did back in, you know, the early hundreds, separating the mind and the body and the soul from each other and saying, oh, no, there's the material and then the spiritual, and they're completely separate. And, you know, you can make your body into whatever you want. And it's just it's a warmed over Gnosticism, honestly. But Paul wrote about this in Corinthians. I've been listening and reading 1st and 2nd Corinthians lately. And, you know, he talks a lot about, you know, sexual immorality. And so this is something that has been an issue for a very, very long time, and it's just part of the sin in us. But in the political realm, right, this is, you know, Satan uses policy, he uses people to advance a particular movement to confuse people by creating communities that mutually support one another, because misery loves company, right? And if you're around a bunch of other people who are as miserable as yourself and you don't realize how miserable you are, you don't know that you could actually be happy and fulfilled by being the person that God created you to be, and acknowledging that he created you that way for a reason. And so, yes, I've seen that. I agree with you. You know, so how did we get here? What was the road to where we are? It started with the, you know, the psychologist saying, well, you know, homosexuality is really not a pathology. Used to be considered that way, and then they said, no, that's not a pathology, and that opened the door to the LGBTQ movement. And, you know, over decades, they have had a plan, Satan's had a plan, they've had a plan to move all these things, and now they've gone from the LGB to the T. And it's interesting because it's creating some tension, because there are some LGs and Bs who aren't so cool with the T's, which is another conversation. We don't have to go there, but it's interesting to observe. But now the door is open to the T. And where did it start? Well, you know, in California in 2012, first one out of the gates, good old California, Jerry Brown, moonbeam governor, signed the law that prohibited licensed therapists from engaging in counseling with minors to, quote-unquote, change their sexual orientation or gender identity. Now, let's stop for just a second here, because you and I have talked about language. Language matters. And they call this conversion therapy ban, which is a twisted, demented, and self-reflexive terminology designed to get you to think that conversion therapy is bad. Just the very words of it, oh, we're converting someone from something. That's bad, because they are the way they are, and we can't convert them because we got to let people be the way they want to be, right? That's what this word picture is intended to do.
It also has this connotation of necessarily, you know, evangelizing or proselytizing, right? Conversion, most people think of that in the sense of like the church, right?
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, good point. And yeah, but let's remember, the LGB movement used to use the term sexual preference. They changed it purposefully to the word orientation in order to give it the imprimatur, or the character of immutable characteristic, so that it would fit within the court's confines of strict scrutiny and immutable characteristics and, you know, anti-discrimination, which we'll get to here in a minute. But it started in California, 2012, 2013. New Jersey picked it up, and then immediately the lawsuit started. And you had the very beginnings in the Ninth Circuit, because therapists challenged that. You know, they're like, no, we should be able to talk with people and help them if they want to overcome these unwanted thoughts that they have. I mean, we all have unwanted thoughts, and it's not wrong to go to someone to get some help with that. So they challenged that, and there were two cases, one in the Ninth, one in the Third Circuit, and those circuits upheld those laws, saying, well, you know, there's this thing called professional speech versus regular speech, and the court created this classification in, you know, under free speech doctrine called professional speech, and they gave it a lower level of judicial protection. And at that time, let's remember, we had a court that Justice Kennedy, who wrote Obergefell, was on, and so he wasn't very friendly, and so the court did not take up those cases. They didn't have any interest in overturning them. So that's where that started, and then we had some changes. I'm going to talk about the changes, or you want to interject?
Yeah, no, I just am thinking, you know, the whole history of all of this, it's so important to understand this legacy. And when you're talking about how the left, you know, language matters, and when they adjusted their language and their terminology to go from preference to orientation, that is really a key moment, I think. And as you described, Mike Donnelly, it's key because a preference just means like, you know, hey, I prefer, you know, vanilla to chocolate, or, you know, this is my preference, but it's not necessarily a right. I don't necessarily have a right to all of my preferences. But when it's something that the left is changing into, this is something that's so intrinsic to my humanity, that I have a right to be treated with dignity and respect. We see those words used alongside this whole trans narrative, that, you know, you have to affirm who I am as, you know, as a person. I mean, we see kind of all the same terminology as almost like disability language, like in a weird way, because obviously the left would never say that a different sexual orientation, you know, it's never a disability. It's not something, you know, that is a negative thing, but they use all of the same terminology. Like, we need to accommodate that. We need to ensure that they're treated with dignity and respect. Like, they use all of those same terms, probably just because then it's this base requirement for the law to have to treat them preferentially. And to say, you know, you have to, as long as we're treating everyone with equality, then you can't hire and fire on that basis. You can't now counsel, you know, differently on that basis. You can't deny them, you know, healthcare access. And they term that with, you know, this gender affirming care, you know, so all of this, it all goes into the same thing. And this is a little bit off topic, but I think it actually relates to this whole conversation. I really think as well, with this rise of all of this trans nonsense, one of the worst things that we have done legally, and I'm actually writing a second book on this topic, but legally, one of the worst things that we've allowed our judiciary to do, and even, you know, our Congress and executive, but we have taken what the founders described as natural rights, the laws of nature and of nature's God, things that mirror reality, that are an explanation built on discoverable, self-evident truth that's outside our opinion. It's self-evident, natural law. And we have transformed natural rights into so-called civil rights. That becomes a creature of our imagination, our reality, a creature of the state. And it's taking rights and not only transforming them into mere privileges, but it's also suggesting that anything that society wants to designate as a civil right can be done with the same authority as natural rights, which is basically a substitution of our preferences as humans and the secular humanist worldview, saying that we are the be-all and end-all and arbiters of our own reality, that we are substituting now our preferences and our selective judgment and what we would like to affirm and accommodate, replacing that with natural law.
I think that's very well said. I completely agree with you. I mean, the Bible says there is a way that seems right to a man, and that is a way that leads unto death, right? I mean, you know, Isaiah wrote, you know, people want to be seen as right in their own eyes. They want to be able to define for themselves the reality, and then they want everyone else to recognize it and government to protect it and government to prevent other people from treating them, you know, differently. As a basis of it, when what they're doing is immoral, wrong, and harmful in and of itself. So I agree with you.
Yeah,
and I think, and you know, it's interesting. You said you know, gender affirming care. I mean, to me, it's neither affirming nor is it care. What they call gender affirming care. It doesn't affirm the person's gender. It denies their gender because there is a reality. There is an objective truth, and you know that's what's at issue here, really. When you talk about conversion therapy ban, really what that is a reality denying perspective. That's what that is. You know, you can have your perspective if you want to, but you can't use the government to require everyone else to agree with your perspective. And that is what is at issue in this case that the Supreme Court heard yesterday.
Right. I mean, and the Supreme Court has recognized that one of the, probably the only right that is absolute is the right to believe. Like, the state isn't going to come in and say, you know, if you deny that the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, and, you know, we deny that the grass is green, you deny that you know, there are the first law of thermodynamics or gravity or whatever, then we're going to punish you for it as the government, right? Like, we can look at you and say, maybe you need mental health. Maybe you need, you know, better education.
Yeah,
maybe
exactly.
You need some
That's
intervention
the point. That's
here.
That's what this is about, is
right?
People getting help for things that they want help with that are mental aberrations,
yes.
Frankly. And we're calling things that are immoral behaviors or things that are wrong good.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, but this is where, you know, you have a right to believe whatever you want, in terms of the state isn't going to necessarily interfere, but when the action then becomes something that is either harming others or even self-inflicted harm, and we need to define harm on an objective basis, mirroring reality, the state not only has the power, but also, I believe, the right and duty and obligation to step in to prevent that. So, for example, when we say that there are laws against suicide, right? I mean, that is the utmost of self-harm. And so when the state steps in and prevents that, puts people on suicide watch, or you can, you know, call in and say, I'm very concerned, and, you know, about a neighbor, a family member, and, you know, the resources of the state will come in and try to help that person. That's objectively saying, we recognize that this behavior is harmful by an objective metric. We don't have these, you know, we don't have in any way, shape, or form, you know, suicide affirmation therapy groups, right? I mean, that would be ridiculous.
Right.
But this is kind of the same, on a little bit lesser scale, this is the same thing that the left is asking, is to say an overtly objective metric to damage your sexual organs and those of a minor especially permanently is absolutely harmful. And to suggest that that is okay for a doctor to do, for a physician, but then that a licensed therapist can't even try to counsel someone out of self-harm is utterly irrational, but it's in the name of civil rights, and it's in the name of saying you are the arbiter of your own reality. And that's the underlying basis of this, is that what the state of Colorado and these other 20 states, that's ultimately the worldview that they're presenting, is that we want to say that an individual, when it comes to sex, their sex and gender, they're the arbiter of their own reality. That is patently absurd in every context. And getting to this case, and I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but getting to the specifics of this case, it was so frustrating to me, Mike, to see that the Solicitor General of Colorado was literally arguing this. And our advocates, well, you know, Alliance Defending Freedom does a great job. And, you know, there was also one of the DOJ Solicitor Generals was also part of this argument, you know, trying to get this Colorado law overturned. They didn't say it this plainly. They didn't say, look, what Colorado is arguing for is denying reality. And in no other way should our law ever deny reality. Why can't advocates for truth who are on the right side of this, why do they always have to couch everything in like the doctrines and the, you know, all of this legal hyperbole and everything? Why can't they just say it that plainly?
Well, I agree with you. I wish they would. And Donald Trump has. He has an executive order that defines men and women for federal government purposes. And I do believe that our courts should also do the same thing. But I think, you know, this is why we are where we are at with the Supreme Court. When you go back to the very beginning, you know, lawyers who are part of the highly educated elite in the country come up with creative ideas, and then they create these frameworks, and they argue within these frameworks, and they just kind of get disconnected a little bit from reality. And I think they're thinking, oh, we have to appeal to the court in the court's terms, when really they should just state reality plainly, as you have suggested. And I agree, it is frustrating. We need to come back to what is really at issue, as we talked about at the very beginning here. But then at the end of the day, the Supreme Court does need to figure out a way within the context of its opinions and its jurisprudential prison that it has created for itself, built up upon precedent over centuries of smart lawyers who get on the court and then make these decisions over time, just like Brutus in Anti-Federalist 15 said would happen when he was arguing against, you know, the judiciary and how it would become a power second not even to heaven, is what Brutus said in Anti-Federalist 15. I encourage people to go read Anti-Federalist 15 because 200 plus years ago, Brutus, who wrote it, called out exactly what we're dealing with now. Mm-hmm. You know, how do we fix it? Well, that's a longer conversation.
Yes. And we've done a lot of shows on that, and we'll have to do maybe a deep dive on, you know, fixing all of that, because while we had the, you know, we have our U.S. Constitution and it's our highest law of the land, and this is, you know, a great way to divide power, to limit power. And the Federalist Papers were in support of the ratification of the U.S. Constitution in its original form in 1787. And then, of course, you know, there were also some talking about the Bill of Rights and so forth. The Anti-Federalist Papers are very important because I think they actually did outline really well some of the flaws that we're seeing. I mean, and no document's going to be perfect. I mean, this isn't like the Bible that's inerrant, right? I mean, our U.S. Constitution,
that's right.
While it's a great form of government, and it's possibly the best form, arguably, that we've had in world history,
yep.
That doesn't mean it's infallible or that it's inerrant. So we have to understand that as patriots.
And it's been corrupted. And I would say that that's the problem, is that it's been corrupted from its original intent by the people themselves, by our ancestors did things that set the stage for what we're experiencing today, not just in this area, but in many other areas. So I agree with you.
Yeah. So we have to always keep that in mind, as much as, you know, you and I are both, I think, among the most ardent patriots who love our U.S. Constitution, who advocate for it. But yes, we advocate for it in the original form and philosophy that was founded in our Declaration, that necessarily requires a recognition that truth is self-evident, that our rights come from God, our creator. They're not these civil rights that are fashioned, that are outside reality, that are formed by, you know, the consent of whatever morons are currently on the U.S. Supreme Court or sitting in Congress or otherwise. I mean, so we have to go back ultimately to truth. So as we are looking, though, at this particular case, you've given us a little bit of the context of how we got to this case, Childs v. Salazar, at the Supreme Court this week. But how did this actually get to the U.S. Supreme Court and the arguments that we heard this week?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so we left off a little while ago talking about the beginning, which was in 2013-15. You had two cases in the Third and Ninth Circuit where those appeals courts upheld these so-called, I'm not going to call them conversion therapy bans, these reality-denying laws. And then you had a turning point, which was NIFLA. And NIFLA was a case about, also from California. California, it all comes out of California, the land of fruits and nuts, right? Good old California. And NIFLA was a case where the state of California required pregnancy crisis centers to put up people coming in there saying that they could get abortions. And Justice Thomas wrote the majority opinion. It was a 5-4 opinion joined by Kennedy and Gorsuch, who is now on the court, having replaced Antonin Scalia, who died a year before. And so in NIFLA, Justice Thomas basically said, no, we're getting rid of this professional speech business. Speech is speech, and it gets the highest level of protection. And so that kind of created a real shift, but we haven't realized the benefit of that until now. I think we're going to realize the benefit of that now when the court rules on this case. But then what you had is in Florida, you had some cities in Florida that were passing these so-called conversion therapy bans, these reality-denying ordinances, and they were sued, and the 11th Circuit struck them down, basically saying that, no, this is prohibited because it is discriminating against one viewpoint, okay? So viewpoint discrimination is part of free speech jurisprudence, and it's particularly pernicious, as the court has said, and it's presumptively unconstitutional. So if you can get a court to say that something that you're complaining about is viewpoint discrimination, you're pretty much guaranteed to win. And that's what happened in Otto v. City of Boca Raton. Boca Raton must be the California of Florida. I don't know. You could tell me if that's true or not. So then fast forward a little bit, you had another case coming out of the Ninth Circuit, which went to the court, but the court denied cert in 2023. And then, you know, Colorado's law, which was passed in 2019, and the court, you know, last year, and they heard the arguments yesterday. And what this did, when you had the third and the ninth versus the 11th, you had what's called a circuit split. You had one set of circuits ruling one way, you had another circuit ruling another way, and the Supreme Court, you know, is there to resolve these things because we can't have two different ways of interpreting the Constitution in different parts of the country, and the Supreme Court is there to unify that. And so they took this case and they heard it yesterday, and as you pointed out what it was, you know, Colorado passed this law saying no licensed counselor can engage in talk therapy or having a conversation with someone who has come to them wanting help with gender dysphoria issues. And that's what is at issue in the court. And with, you know, the specific issues that the court is trying to figure out here is, one, is therapy, is therapy conduct or is it speech? Is it just speech or is it actually conduct? And that's a kind of a very technical, somewhat technical argument. And then if it's speech, is it viewpoint discrimination? And if it's viewpoint discrimination or if it's speech, does it survive strict scrutiny? And strict scrutiny is the highest level of judicial protection that a right can have. And basically what it says is, you know, if you are complaining against the government, violating one of your rights, say right to free speech, as in this case, the government has to demonstrate that it has a compelling interest, and that's really high. That's a really high bar. And secondly, it also has to prove that what it's doing is the most narrowly tailored or the least restrictive means to achieve that specific compelling objective. And so here, Colorado is arguing that they have a compelling interest in regulating medical treatment, which is true-ish. You know, the states are the place that regulates medical treatment, you know, licenses doctors and make sure that people are being treated by licensed doctors and aren't being, you know, subject to quacks or, you know, having their legs cut off for no good reason, for example.
Or their genitalia, you know. Or their genitalia. I mean, just throwing that out there.
But, well, yeah. That is happening.
Yeah.
Tragically. So at any rate, right, exactly. So that's what the court is trying to figure out, because you had this professional speech, which got a lower level of protection. There are three levels of protection that the court provides to rights. One is, or to challenges, government action versus people, compelling and the strict scrutiny, where it's a compelling interest and least restrictive means is the analysis. Intermediate scrutiny, where you have to have only an important government purpose, and then you have to have a substantial relationship between what the government's doing and its interest. And then you've got rational basis review, which is the lowest level of protection. And in fact, it's interesting, Justice Kennedy used rational basis review, in Obergefell to uphold same-sex marriage and overturn 32 state constitutional amendments defining marriage as a man and a woman. Okay, so that's your constitutional lesson for the day: strict scrutiny, intermediate scrutiny, rational basis. And so here, the counselor is challenging the Colorado law, saying under the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution that law should receive strict scrutiny because it is a restriction on the counselor's speech.
And this whole idea of speech versus conduct, and especially in the context that you were just describing of, and there was conversation in oral argument yesterday, you know, of medical malpractice, for example, of saying, well, you know, of course, the state has an interest in regulating the licensures of medical professionals, you know, doctors and all of this to ensure that they're not performing harmful surgeries, for example, or they're not prescribing medications that are harmful, you know, the other of these things that are conduct. And I thought this was a really interesting kind of line that that the Colorado as the state was trying to draw this into. And you know, to me, though, Mike, ultimately, it really doesn't matter in terms of conduct or speech. I mean, it does to the overall legal argument of, you know, what's protected by First Amendment purely. But in terms of the ultimate outcome of this type of therapy, and to say that a licensed counselor should be able to provide this type of help, and whether you want to call that speech, conduct, you know, whatever. To me, the ultimate outcome really doesn't depend on that. It depends on more so what are we actually calling harmful, and where is the line between, for example, you know, if I go into a doctor's office and I say, you know, here's you know, my issue, and they just counsel me and they say, well, you know, you better eat better, so, you know, eat more fruits and veggies, and, you know, they're counseling me just in terms of speech that ultimately translates into the conduct if I'm taking their advice, versus saying, you know, here's a medication to treat the symptoms, you know, of your underlying issue. All of those things need to be based on reality. And so, you know, to me, I get the legal argument here, but I almost felt like the advocates for the Christian counselors were almost going too far into the weeds with this by just saying, you know, ultimately it really doesn't matter, does it?
Well, I mean, the justices have to, in their opinion, they're going to have to make a determination, because the case was brought on free speech grounds, and so they've got to make some kind of determination of speech conduct. Although I think they. Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. I haven't thought that one through. I guess we'll have to see what they do with that. I'm not really sure how they're going to deal with that. But I think that it is an important distinction. You know, because of the different cases that have come up and how both sides are arguing. You know, Colorado is saying this is medical treatment, right? And they're also saying that it's harmful, though, right? They're saying this reality denying therapy, they call it conversion therapy ban, is harmful. And they don't really have a lot of studies. They cite to some things. And you've got the American Psychological Association that submitted an amicus brief, right? So you've got the medical community who are captured by the politically correct DEI ideology, writing things, saying things, claiming scientific evidence that there's harm if you bring a child who's confused about their gender to a counselor, and that somehow by trying to help them see that they are a boy or they are a girl and realizing that truth is harmful to them. And of course they want, the other side wants to have that because they want kids to just be able to do that so they can groom them and bring them into their community because they want to grow their community. You know, and not everybody would say, they'd say, oh no, it's really because that's who they are and want everybody to be able to decide. But at the end of the day, that's what they're trying to do, is allow people and encourage people to do that. You know, reaching down in the kindergarten with books to sexualize children and protect, and having the government try to protect that. Anyway.
But with all of this though, you know, I totally get where, you know, I mean, this was brought on free speech grounds, and, you know, and some of this, I think that, you know, we the overall, you know, the right who's trying to say, you know, no, that this law is wrong. We're being strategic in how we're bringing these cases, and that's fair. We have to navigate within, you know, this, in my view, largely unconstitutional judicial construct as we have it in 2025. Sure. And so there is a difference, you know, ultimately. And what we're talking about, though, in terms of the actual counseling session, I mean, you know, this is speech because it's presenting an ideological viewpoint that is based in truth and is confronting a patient or a counselee, you know, minor or otherwise, who is asking questions about gender and sex, and that it's a conversation, right? And so it's presenting an ideological viewpoint. So in that sense, I do think that this is purely speech. It's not just conduct. But I guess my point, though, is even if it were conduct, even if the court were to reach that, the argument in the alternative should be, this is still something that ultimately the state cannot prove is harmful, nor does it have any interest in suggesting that this is somehow not a valid method of conduct to resolve the issues that are being presented in this context. I mean, there's nothing that has ever been presented, and, you know, the left can have all of their studies and, you know, whatever, but it's ultimately, at the end of the day, is denying reality. And so what I would have loved to see the advocates make is kind of that argument in the alternative to say, this is totally a purely speech case, and here's why. But then even if the court were to go that far and, you know, yeah, we haven't brought it on this ground, so what, basically? To say, you know, this isn't conduct that they're actually trying to in any way or, you know, to suggest that this court could actually find that this is harmful objectively.
Well, I think you're right about that. I mean, you could even see how they might even just say, well, you know what? The state has an interest in regulating the medical community, but this is not rationally related to that. And they could even use rational basis review, in my opinion, to do what you just said, which is to find that, you know, preventing parents, because there's a parents element here, not just, you know, minors don't just bring themselves to these counseling sessions, although that does happen probably sometimes. Parents are the ones who are bringing them. And so you've got a confluence here of a parental right also being able to decide what's in the best interest of their child and what kind of medical treatment they should receive, if you want to call it treatment or not treatment, and, you know, what kind of help they should get. And so, that, you know, I analogized this case a little bit to Pierce v. Society of Sisters, where the court said that states cannot require children to go only to public schools and receive public instruction only from publicly, you know, hired teachers. It's kind of similar here that, you know, the court could say, no, the state of Colorado cannot require parents to bring their children who are having mental issues to counselors who only parrot what the government wants them to say. It's the same thing. That's totally illegitimate, and it violates parents' rights, while it also is violating the free speech rights of the counselor. So there's a lot of things here where the court can kind of pull on, and ultimately my view is that the court is going to rule in favor of the counselor, I think on viewpoint discrimination grounds, and I think it's going to be a 7-2 judgment. And why do I say that? Because I think Kagan is going to go along. And why do I say that? Because of a question she asked. Because she said, if a doctor says, I know, I'm quoting her, I know you identify as gay, and I'm going to help you accept that. And another doctor says, I know you identify as gay, and I'm going to help you to change that. And one of those is permissible, and the other is not. That seems like viewpoint discrimination. So I think Justin Kagan gets it. And unless she was just being coy, I feel like, you know, this is a bridge too far for Colorado and for all of these states that have done this ideologically driven legislation to prevent parents from getting help for their children. And I think the court is gonna call it out, and it's going to be a very important decision for, for sanity.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and you know, and as you're describing this, Mike, I mean, I'm reminded too. I mean, even if we're talking about medical treatment, I mean, there is a right in this country to seek medical treatment from, you know, your preferred person, and to also say, you know, I want to go seek a second opinion from a doctor, or I want to go to alternative medicine. I mean, people treat things, you know, like cancers, for example. They don't have to go along with either the surgery or the chemotherapy that a traditional, you know, mainstream doctor would advise. Sometimes they go and get other types of, you know, natural sorts of therapies and other things. And that's certainly more conduct than it just is speech. And even in that context, we're allowed to, in this country, determine, you know, what course of treatment we prefer, because it's, I mean, that's part of our rights in terms of our own bodies and on healthcare, if you want to put it in that lane. So, you know, this is just showing, though, in under every different analysis, this law needs to fail. And I think that's the bottom line. But your overall prediction is that this law will be overturned. Is that, do you think it will be under a viewpoint discrimination analysis or kind of a broader analysis, and what's your, if we can read the tea leaves, what's your prediction in terms of which justices be in the majority?
Well, you're going to have Kagan and the six conservatives, I think. You had Justice Barrett, who said, you know, if Florida can't ban gender-affirming counseling, how can Colorado ban the opposite, right? Alito said the state's interest doesn't override viewpoint neutrality. The government cannot pick winners in ideological debates. So, I mean, I think, you know, Gorsuch, you know, said the same thing. He said, why should counselors lose their rights simply because they're licensed if the First Amendment protects speech, even when it happens in professional settings? So I think it's going to be viewpoint-based discrimination. I mean, it's pretty obvious this is a viewpoint. It's hardly even thinly veiled. And Justice Thomas opened the door by getting rid of professional speech in NIFLA. And I think, to me, this is a pretty straightforward application of NIFLA and viewpoint discrimination speech principles, and the law fails.
And I hope and pray for that, and that this will be a very solid opinion, not like what we saw in Masterpiece, that ultimately it was the right outcome, but a very weak opinion in terms of its overall application.
I feel like it's really important to say two things here, because we have to give credit where credit's due. Number one, we have to be thankful for Mitch McConnell, even though he's not my hero at all. Okay, I'm very not a big fan of Mitch McConnell. But McConnell held the line when Obama nominated Merrick Garland after Scalia died. Secondly, Donald Trump won in part because he said, here's who I would appoint to the Supreme Court. And then he did that. And the first one was Neil Gorsuch, who took Scalia's spot. And then you had Kavanaugh, who took Breyer's spot. And then you had Barrett, who took Ginsburg's spot. And so we have to give the president a lot of credit for the picks that he put on the court, which ultimately resulted in Roe v. Wade being overturned and resulted in Scrimeti upholding the Tennessee ban on these horrible treatments, these chemical castrations and these physical mutilations of children, and now is going to say, no, the state cannot pick winners through medical regulation in an ideological debate. That's what they said in Scrimeti. You know, Thomas wrote a great concurrence in Scrimeti, talking about how, the medical community is not immune from being captured by political ideology. That's for sure. We know that, and they're not afraid to call that out. So that's I'm pretty confident. But let's schedule, another podcast for 5 months from now, and we'll see if I'm right.
Yeah. Well, and I hope that you're right, and I think so. And I think that, even with all of this just absolute nonsense of doctrines and different things, that we've seen from the Supreme Court, especially in the last, 50 and 60 years, even longer than that, it's going to take a while to kind of erode all of those problems and to turn, kind of wind this back and to get it going back in the right direction. As one of my favorite quotations says, and I forget who said this, but it's like, if you get on the wrong train, the quickest way to get back to where you're going is to get off at the soonest stop. It's like you're not just going to magically, go back to where you were. You're going to have wasted, some time, and you'll be down the track further than you wanted to. But the quickest way to get to where you're actually trying to go is to get off at the soonest stop. So we need to start, exiting all of these bad doctrines, these bad theories, the bad view of, the judicial overreach as soon as possible. We're seeing that in some cases like Dobbs, hopefully now, like the Childs case. We've seen, 303 Creative, some of these, and a lot of these that are arising out of my former home state of Colorado, which is basically the testing ground of all of this, but, California as well, overall. I mean, NIFLA was based there. And so we're seeing some of these start to kind of get off the train that is headed, toward the LGBTQ insanity. And so that we can be thankful for, and it's going to take some time, but I think hopefully we're headed in the right direction. So Mike Donnelly, really appreciate you joining today. Some closing thoughts on, where we're at in this cultural battle overall.
Well, Jenna, I appreciate that. I mean, we know the end from the beginning. God told us how it ends. We know how it began. And ultimately, that's the battle that we're called to fight. And we have to remember that people are not our enemy. We do not war with flesh and blood, but with powers and principalities in the unseen realms, to quote Ephesians. And, these people who are confused, and some of whom become very violent. It was a transgender. I mean, there's been a lot of transgender, so-called transgender motivated violence in recent weeks. Charlie Kirk's assassin was motivated by that ideology. This is a dangerous ideology. But as Jesus said about Satan, he's been a liar from the beginning and a murderer. And so we shouldn't be surprised about the violence that we're facing and the tactics that we're facing and the strategies that we're facing from the enemy. But we have to remember that he's the enemy. These people are his tools, and they are also created in the image of God. And so
I think we lost you there for a second, Mike.
You lost me because my heart breaks for these people.
Oh. Mm.
Because they're so lost.
Mm.
And we know the truth. And so let's try to, you know, even as we stand firm and fight, right, and put on the full armor of God and fight through policy and fight in righteousness, let's also remember that those people on the other side, some of them are willing combatants, but all of them are created in the image of God and are, you know, God wants to reach them also. And you know, it's interesting, Jenna, you know, as we close, you know, on X, I've seen so many people saying things like, you know, I never went to church and now I'm going to church because of Charlie Kirk, or, you know, I've finally seen the truth and it's like a walk away moment. You know, there's so many people. And so I'm very encouraged. God is clearly moving in the younger generation. That's very clear from research. And, you know, but why would we be surprised by that? God is always moving. He's always working. And we just need to be prepared to do what he's calling us to do, where he's called us to do it, whether that's witnessing to a family member or a neighbor or being a strong policymaker or someone like yourself who's speaking the truth through the media. Each one of us can do something, and ultimately what we need to do is reach people with the gospel.
So well said. And, you know, I echo that very heartfelt sentiment of just, you know, my heart breaks for the people who have been taken in by this false ideology. And as they're confronting the desperation of all of us who cry out for meaning, for purpose, for understanding of the world, and ultimately for a reconciled relationship with our Creator, they have bought into the lie that changing your sex or being in all of these, you know, ridiculous relationships and other things, that's the solution. You know, finding God replacements or God substitutes, basically, as Nancy Piercy calls them in her book, Finding Truth. These God substitutes that ultimately will not fulfill, they will not provide an answer to that desperation, and it will create more and more and more despair as people are seeing that it's not the answer. And I think we're seeing in real time some of the just horrifically tragic effects of that, like some of these people who are committing violence, and we're seeing in some of their manifestos that they're saying, you know, I bought into the trans movement and I realized that that's not true. You know, obviously paraphrasing, but it's they're being confronted with the reality that this isn't the answer. And of course, lashing out in violence is also not the answer, but it leads them to the point of utter despair. And the church, meaning us, we the Christians who have knowledge of the truth, who have the knowledge of Christ, have an obligation to respond in this moment with the truth. And that's why, you know, we can talk about the Supreme Court law, policy, all of that absolutely matters, because we don't want people to be able to have access to these lies, and we want them to be able to have access to the truth. But ultimately, it comes down to we need to share the gospel, teach the truth in every way and at every opportunity that we can. And this is why we need to hopefully... our society should uphold the right of Christian therapists to simply speak the truth. That's why this matters. And so, Mike, I really appreciate that. And to bring this down ultimately to the bottom line, which is that we have to preach Christ. We preach Christ and we share Christ. And that is what all of this is all about. So you have been listening to On Demand with Jenna Ellis and my guest, Mike Donnelly. Today, you can follow him on X at Donnelly Speaks. You can follow me on X at Real Jenna Ellis, on other platforms at Jenna Ellis Media. You can listen to the daily broadcast of Jenna Ellis in the morning from 8 to 9 Eastern live or on the podcast page at AFR.net. Share this broadcast with anyone that you can who is wondering about this particular case or even just wanting to understand the rise of the trans lie in America. And we will join you next week on demand as we continue to have these very, very important conversations.